Welcome to the Student Housing Insight Podcast, where we are putting you in touch with the people who bring student housing to life. This episode is brought to you by studenthousingsites.com. If you currently have a land opportunity or looking for a land opportunity in student housing markets across the U.S., please take a chance to go to studenthousingsites.com and look at the platform that Mike Spencer, the owner, has put together. He is literally crowdsourcing the process of locating land in student housing markets. Go check out studenthousingsites.com. Welcome to the podcast, everyone, and welcome, Greta.
Hey, thanks, man.
Hey, sorry we couldn't be in studio today, but I appreciate you calling in.
No problem. I'm sure you miss my face.
Of course I do. So I'm going to be in Tampa next week attending the NMHC Student Housing Conference. NMHC stands for National Multi-Housing Council. It's a group located in D.C. that I think more than anything, they're really kind of a advocate and lobbyist group for members that are in the apartment multifamily space, which includes student housing and senior housing. Really making sure that our government leaders know what the needs are for developers and operators, but also just provide some wonderful services for the members as well. So, this is the group that actually started the first ever student housing conference.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And guess
today
who, attended that one?
Who?
This old man. It was kind of funny because the first time that they did it, it was in D.C., and I will never forget, it was, probably 10, I don't even know if there were 10 actual companies that were there, but probably 8 to 10 companies, maybe not even that much, maybe a total of 40 or 50 people, and we were just all looking at each other saying, so how do you do turn, or how do you operate this way, and no one wanted to say anything because they felt like they were giving away some kind of trade secret.
It was, how long did it take you to ride a horse that far? You guys didn't have cars.
Oh, my God.
I'm just saying.
Probably 10, 15 years ago. It wasn't that long ago. But anyway. This year it's going to be down in Tampa, and I'm looking to meet a lot of folks. Actually, spoke with the guys at NMHC, and they're actually going to be going to set some time aside to record a podcast. So we'll get to hear from them as well.
Very exciting. That's going to be a good listen. Not to downplay anything of what we've done thus far, because I think that so far some of the stuff that we've done, or all the stuff that's been done, it's been amazing. But I'm excited about that one.
Yeah, and I'm really excited about the interview I got to have this week.
Yes.
Susan Falkemer with Price Company, who is their chief development officer. She really heads up everything as far as both acquisitions and development opportunities for Donna Price and her team. And I really enjoyed this interview, I got to tell you.
She is smart. It's a great interview. She was it's so filled with great information, and she's so concise with her answers. I think it's phenomenal. I love this interview.
Yeah, she is a wealth of information for sure.
Definitely.
She's been in this industry just probably a little bit longer than I have, I think. And
I didn't know that was possible.
Yeah, it is. But we kind of have a similar background of starting out with kitty condos, which you got to learn about a couple episodes ago. and if for anybody else that hasn't heard Choosing a Management Company yet in that podcast, go back and listen to that if you want an explanation of what a kitty condo is. But the insight and the experiences that she's had in this industry is just it really blows you away, and you can't help but talk with her and get very excited about student housing. I mean, she's passionate about it, and she's really passionate about structuring a deal, and that was the reason I asked her to come on the show, because she's certainly a veteran at being able to do that and making sure that all the players are winners. And I wanted to make sure our listeners had an opportunity to hear some of those stories, and I think she did a great job of it.
I agree completely. It was, like I said, it was a great listen, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, hey, let's go ahead and hit play, and we'll come back with some takeaways.
All right.
Susan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, doing great. Hate that we couldn't do this in studio, but I appreciate you calling in and helping our listeners understand your background and the stories you have on the acquisition and development side. I'll let you get into a little bit of explained price and your background, but really quick, just go ahead and walk through what price does.
Sure, sure. Well, again, thank you for your time today. And, I get really excited talking about the student housing industry. I joined Price back in 2003. And prior to that, spent 20 years on the commercial side of the business, acquisition, development, office, retail, and industrial product with regional and national players. And when I joined Price in 2003, it was my first exposure into the multifamily side of the business, and specifically student housing. So I was in for a surprise and a big change, and it's been a lot of fun. Price today has approximately 27,000 beds under management. We have ownership in about 17,000 of those beds. The other are third-party relationships. Those are relationships that we've either acquired and since sold, or developed and sold, or work with a select number of institutional clients and developers to do third-party management. We are in 13 states. I believe we have about 48 projects to date.
Wow.
Currently that we have ownership interest in, about 1.4 million under management. We have about 600 plus employees. We are coast to coast. Our corporate office is located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Again, I joined Price in 2003. And since that time, when I started with Price, they were selling kitty condos. We developed
the kitty condo.
The kitty condo, that's right. A blast from the past. And certainly, I had never heard about it before myself. And we were developing kitty condos around the NC State market, and then went into the Clemson market, I think altogether, probably somewhere around 700 units. And wow. I was coming from C.B. Richard Ellis and in the institutional management brokerage investment sales side of the business. And Donna and I met, and we talked about staying more local in Raleigh, and then again in Clemson. And she had a sales force of about 9 agents that she was using to help develop and sell those kitty condos. And so my first job with Price was to come in and actually manage that sales force.
So cool. Yeah, the... That was kind of where I got my start, not from selling kitty condos, but with a developer that had about a 20-year history at the time of doing kitty condos, Bob Bradley, and then it was really him and I think Mike Moran with Capstone that were really kind of I don't know if pioneering is probably the right title, but they were really the guys that were trying to take it to a national scale and doing a lot of projects. And it was an interesting concept. I was a buyer of it when I was in college, and that's where I tell everybody I got my start in property management on a very, very micro level with a 4-bedroom, 4-bath condo. But it was a great experience, and I think I ended up owning it for about 7 years. But of course, when 2008 happened, because so many of these kitty condo deals were, I think there were really kind of two instances that really kind of killed that business. One was the first-time homebuyer loan. They changed that program so that even though it was a student buying a home for the first time, if it had bedroom-bath parity above 3 bedrooms, it didn't qualify for that for that FHA loan. And I know that's when the Bradleys kind of got out of it. Then, of course, with the Great Recession in 2008, it was hard for parents to, co-sign on those type of deals. But do you think that's ever going to come back?
I hope not. No, I take that back. I think that there certainly is a place and time for, in any cycle, for investment real estate. And I think that whether it is newly developed kitty condos, I kind of doubt that. But look at a lot of projects that are near universities, lower dense projects that maybe already had the condo docs in place. And what a great conversion that might be for an owner to be able to potentially repurpose that into a for sale product. So that would be my best guess. But I don't anticipate ever being involved in it myself. we got out of the kitty condo business after we finished our project in Clemson in 2004 and bought our first project in Raleigh. It was our first apartment project, I should say. And since that time, have focused solely on development and acquisitions of institutional, for rent investment, student housing. So, it's been a lot of fun. There certainly have been lots of changes in the industry, and we'll talk some about that. But my job basically went from managing a sales force, trying to stay local, to, when I first met Donna, I have to tell you the story. When I first met Donna, I saw something in her personally, and I saw something in this business plan that I knew that I could gravitate to and I could add value to. And I was really excited about the thought of growing that business into a more institutional business. Again, didn't know anything about student housing per se, but I knew that the person, the capabilities and the type of industry in its infancy that it was going to be something that would be fun to grow and be involved with. So again, we started growing that business in 2004 on an institutional level. And my role, went from being sales manager to helping to kind of manage the growth of the company. And in 2010, we were hiring people a lot smarter than me to come in and do those kinds of things. And so my goal was to refocus on just acquisition and development, which I've had the pleasure of doing since that point in time. And so that's what I focus on today. And, having a good time. It's a fabulous industry to be involved with.
That it is. So let's talk about a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about those trends. What have you seen in student housing during your tenure, beyond what you described there, which I think was great. And what do you see on the horizon, specifically with student housing development and structuring partnerships and bringing on investors? What are the trends you've seen? Where do you see it? What do you see on the horizon going forward?
Sure. So, looking back, obviously, we have been focused on garden style, a mile plus away from campus product on both the acquisition and the development side, up through just the past few years. And, as it relates to those kind of projects, obviously the physical plant was your typical garden style walk up, your larger bedrooms, bed bath parity, parking parity, great amenities, shuttles to campus, all those typical things that people thought of for student housing. And our investors at that point of time were largely high net worth individuals that focused on development with us and some acquisitions. As the projects got larger, we were introduced to private equity groups like the Harrison Streets and the Blue Vistas, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And those were kind of the next wave of investors that we worked with. We subsequently, from a natural evolution, you go into the insurance companies, the pension funds, and the opportunity to work with those groups on even larger types of investments, both on the acquisition and development side. And as the product type changed and evolved into a more pedestrian requirement, both for our wants and needs and from the industries, the students' wants and needs, and from the investors' wants and needs, then obviously the investment and the structures change. So today, mm-hmm. obviously, we're focused on, as probably just like everybody else, we're focused on more of the pedestrian to campus product, both on the acquisition and development. Although we'll go back and talk a little bit more about, our value add strategy, because that is a specific strategy we have too. But pedestrian to campus, and so you've got smaller units, you give up that bed bath parity in some cases. I know there was just an article in the most recent Student Housing magazine that talked about that, interviewed obviously all the greatest folks in our industry about their thoughts on bed bath parity specifically. You give up parking parity. Obviously your cost of construction is driving a lot of those decisions, and the need to keep rent in line, if you would, with other comparable products as well as other options that the students might have, both on and off campus. So, a little the physical plant has changed. Technology is a big part of what we look at today, infrastructure wise, as well as the types of furnishings and fixtures that we're using for delivery in these luxury Class A products, mm-hmm. I would say. And then the investors have changed. So you're beyond that high net worth. You're, you know, particularly in some cases beyond the private equity whose joint venture terms may not meet up with what the developer is looking for in terms of, you know, their expectations on partnership structures. So you're seeing other types of equity come into play. Institutional equity has certainly been there for some time. So, you know, again, we've gotten to a point now where we see trends moving forward on both the acquisition and development side as more geared towards international money coming into the space. And yeah. over the past 24 months, we've seen a large number of international players entering into our space with a hungry appetite for both acquisition of core plus product, as well as on the development side of the business. And for us at Price, the kind of opportunity this creates is we love to partner with folks. We love to partner in the terms of opportunity, in the terms of risk, and in the terms of greater minds, collectively are better than a single source. So what we've looked to are co-development opportunities with larger, non-typical student developers. So developers of an international level that have not specifically done a lot of student housing, that are looking to get into our market in a very core way. And partnering with those groups, which also potentially bring international funds associated with them to develop high-end core product moving forward. Mm-hmm. So specifically for Price, that is a strategy that we've deployed. From a investment perspective, in addition to the international capital that we've seen over the last 24 months, you're also seeing even some more interesting syndication of dollars through crowdsource funding or crowdfunding or however, whatever name you want to give it. And there was an email that just came across my desk today about a company out of the UK that was using, you know, crowdfunding to source and collect, high net worth individuals in a syndication. And then you subscribed to that list, if you would, by venture of this company that had been established to manage that. So I don't know where that's going, but I do know that, you know, we're still in, while it may be the peak of the hot cycle, we're still in a cycle where we are seeing, you know, more international interest in development and acquisitions, and we're continuing to see those of us that are developing look for sites, look for opportunities, and develop.
One question on those many sources. One I didn't hear you mention, or if you did, I missed it. And I'm not really sure that there's a lot of folks in student housing that have used this, but I don't know that I've heard of Price Company using it at all. But a TIC. Have you guys ever done that? And, you know, kind of what's your take on that strategy?
The tenant in common.
Yeah.
We have attempted to and have successfully bought a few TIC owned operated properties. And in my opinion, we're not in the fundraising business. Mm-hmm. So raising our own fund or deploying a TIC type fund or just creating a large syndication of our own high net worth investors is not something that we are currently engaged in doing. So I don't know what I think about others that might be looking at the tenant in common type of equity. But what I do know is that those that have been on the selling side of the tenant in common projects have maybe not fared as well as what they thought when they first went into the deals.
Yeah.
And for us buyers, it's created opportunities because, again, with the lack of the ability to be able to raise the capital that's needed to put in these deals every few years to refresh them, to refresh the amenities or the units or the internet or whatever it is that needs to be refreshed, but the lack of the ability to raise that capital really hampers them in terms of staying at rate with market rent and being able to really benefit, obviously, from some of the rate compression that we've seen, cap rate compression that we've seen.
Yeah, that's what I've I've observed, and fortunately, well, I haven't experienced it yet, but that's certainly what I've observed. So Susan, for the folks in the audience who are considering their first student housing development, which this is, you know, what this first season of the podcast is kind of dedicated to. All right, let's assume they have experience developing other types of commercial real estate. Walk them through what to expect that will be different in structuring a purpose-built student housing deal. And what I mean by that, you know, what types of things will need to be in place for financing and maybe even the municipal process. Can you expand on that?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that I would advise anybody getting into this, and again, we are working with folks that are just getting into the side of the business, is to make sure you are working with an experienced operator. That is the key to ensuring that your market research is done accurately and that you understand market research as it relates to student housing specifically, that you understand how to design effectively a product that is going to be delivered 2 to 3 years from now, or if you're acquiring, that you understand how to retrofit potentially that project through targeted CapEx, and that you understand how to successfully execute the business plan. And without those things to assist you in the delivery, which is the next key point I'll get to, then you're not going to get the financing that you want from a bank, a regional, national, an insurance company, whoever might be doing and looking at your financing for you. So you're going to need that experienced operator. Yeah. You want them a part of your team, which I can't express enough. Again, not just on the research side and then the future business execution side, but also from understanding the timetables for delivery. It's one of those things that I can't stress enough, that you have a hard stop on construction. You have a timeline that every developer and general contractor thinks that they certainly understand when they're putting forward their project. There are always going to be issues that, unless you understand the consequences of a late delivery on student housing, you might not be willing to make some of those hard decisions at the beginning and through the middle of the project to make sure that you're delivering that project on time.
And if it doesn't happen on time, hopefully you chose a market that actually has a good number of hotels.
and the owner that you're working with, you're a third-party developer, and the owner that you're working with may not want to exercise that expense and think about the disastrous consequences of having students that don't get into units and don't have other outlet resources. It could be a complete catastrophe. So if you're getting into the first time, make sure you're talking with and you're working with experienced operators, somebody preferably that has development experience that can help you with those issues. And from a municipal perspective, you know, not always do towns and gowns get along. And you might think if you're going to go build in student housing around a university, and the university, you've done your supply and demand, and your university needs those beds, that the town certainly understands that there's going to be student housing delivered around those universities. Well, some towns create unfavorable zoning that really hampers your ability to put the product in that the students need and the university wants. And so understanding how to deal with those issues and how to recognize those up front so that you don't get into a circumstance and where you're, you know, you've wasted time and effort, you know, and you're under contract on something that's not going to be able to be delivered, and how to work with those municipalities to help them understand what you're delivering and how you're delivering it, and get them as an advocate for those neighbors who further don't understand why there needs to be student housing close to their neighborhoods to house these wild and rowdy students, and help us gain access in a way where they're advocates for us so that we can educate the neighbors about what we're trying to do, which is provide responsible, safe student dwellings and create those environments where the students can flourish and get them out of those neighborhoods where the neighbors don't want them to be anyway. So, you know, it's just a different set of circumstances. Just like any other asset class, there will be, and you just have to understand what those issues might be and try to have a team prepared to go and confront those in the very beginning.
Yeah. If for anybody in the audience that's a novice student housing developer or owner, or hope to be owner, please take heed to what Susan was just saying, because if you've got a deal in a place like Chapel Hill or Charlottesville, Virginia, that is, it's so key having to educate the community on it and really get into a lot of the analytical data of why it's going to be a benefit to the community at large. So So that's great. Anything else on that question, Susan?
Sure. And I guess the only other thing, you know, we talked a little bit about the financing side. The lender is going to look for that operator. But also, if you're a developer and you're looking for LP equity, the LP equity is going to absolutely require the same thing. So you want to make sure that, you know, again, you've partnered with the right groups. And that LP equity may come from your relationship with a student housing operator / developer. So, you know, I guess that's advice I can give you.
Yeah, there used to be a day where that was, you know, banks didn't require it, but it's it's absolutely required now. You know, except in some situations where you've got a tight-knit community. You know, Lynchburg, Virginia, and Liberty University is a good example. There's going to be very few folks that are going to come from outside of Lynchburg that are going to be able to go in and have something that speaks to that student, and that you'll be able to have a good relationship with the university. I've seen some areas like that where they don't want, you know, an ACH, a Price, you know, any right. of these national groups coming in. They want someone operating it that understands, you know, the community. So
the best advice I can give them is hire one of those groups to be your asset manager.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. So, Susan, give some examples of when something went wrong, and this is kind of the passing of the torch that you get to do with with all of these listeners that are out there. Give some examples of when something went wrong with a deal, either pre or post delivery, that now that you look back on it, that could have been avoided, and what did you learn from it?
Well, I'll do two different things. One on the development side, where again we talked about you have a hard date. And delivery and being able to accommodate the residents if there is a time frame issue with delivery is imperative. And we have had a couple of instances where we were late. And you know, we look back and we try to figure out how we could have avoided that. And the best thing that I can say is, you know, you have to make sure that the general contractors that you're working with, the partners that you're working with, the LP or ownership structure that you're working with, depending on all those relationships, understand the consequences. And if one of those parties, you know, is like a mule in the mud and doesn't want to budge either on budgetary dollars or on flexibility, on how we're delivering product or how we're delivering certain trades, or accelerating construction out of sync. If any one of those groups causes a delay in that, then that can further exacerbate the ability to deliver on time. And so making sure you're working with the right group and that you understand how to plan well in advance of what all the possibilities could possibly be, and then there will be others, and be real-time partners. Ownership, general contractors, et cetera, set up your contracts, set up your relationships such that you have the ability to influence that those decisions get made to avoid the ultimate consequence of delivering late, which then creates that snowball or domino effect for the ability to fill the reputational issues, the ability to raise rent the next year, significant concessions, all right. of those things where nobody was thinking about at the time of the decision.
So let me ask something specific to that.
Sure.
Would you prefer more of a, for those partners to be a JV, or do you think it needs to remain more so on the way that the contract is structured and written, that they've got, you know, some penalties to pay if it's not done on time? Which one of those would you prefer, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
Sure. I don't like to have to deploy penalties to motivate somebody to do something. What I look for and our group looks for is the way that we structure our general contracts and the way that we structure our joint ventures such that we create carrots and motivation for completing on time and on budget. And that we incentivize our internal group, our internal development team, to do the same thing. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's always different in every circumstance. But I will tell you again that we've had late deliveries. There are those kinds of things. If you look back and you learn, and really what we focus on now is trying to create those environments so that we can have greater influence and control over all of those elements to be able to make those decisions. And, you know, again, working with third parties, sometimes you run into situations where you know, they don't deliver on the back end for students. And from a operational perspective, from our property management perspective, that's, you know, that's the worst case scenario. So we are very picky about any third party development relationships that we enter into just for that reason. On the acquisition side, you know, the best thing I can tell you is that what we used to think that we could fix anything. And, you know, we're going back to that value add strategy we have. We still love some of those projects that are, you know, a mile, 2 miles outside of campus. We have a great CapEx group. We understand how to go in and value those deals and put in the targeted CapEx and create the rate structure that we think will create a really good return on those investments. And so we really like those kinds of projects. But what we've learned is there are some projects that are broken for a reason. And we can't fix everything. So we focus now more on, you know, finding those deals that are good deals in good markets and they've had a good history, but with our operational platform and our CapEx program and our property management execution that we can come in and really take those to the next level. And so we've got a great group of investors that like that value add strategy, excellent team on execution. And so we've started, really another push inside the last 18 months to seek those deals in addition to the core deals that we're doing with some of our partners and to development.
Awesome. So let's venture away from development. You guys have been pretty active on the acquisition side over the past, certainly over the past decade. I couldn't really say over the last 5 years what that's looked like, but let's talk about acquisitions for a second. What type of acquisitions do you seek out? You know, by that, what kind of parameters and opportunities need to exist before price will kind of green light an acquisition?
Sure. Well, let's see. I can give you a little bit of history. So in the past 18 months, I believe our number is around $480 million in acquisitions.
Wow.
And in 24 months, if we look at all the transactions, acquisition, development, dispositions, and recaps, et cetera, we're at about $981 million, I believe. And so we've had a very, very active last 24 months. Through the time that I've been with Price, we've developed around 8,100 beds, about $450 million in value. So we are the fifth largest privately held owner-operator in the space. And so, you know, while we may not be one of the larger three, we have a lot of beds under management. We have a lot of activity. Our group consists of 9 professionals internal to our new business development group, and that is from the president and CIO and myself and our underwriting team and our site selection team and our core development team. And we focus generally on, you know, what you might think, core, value add, and opportunistic investments. Mm-hmm. We, you know, strongly prefer off-market opportunities, but we work with every broker, national broker, regional broker, to source deals. And we like to think that we have a great relationship with all the brokers, and we certainly rely on them and look at every deal that they send our way. Our underwriting team has underwritten, I think, about 150 deals in the last, inside of 12 months. And generally in the course of a year, we're at about an average of about 150 deals. That is a lot of time spent in what we call the fishbowl. And the fishbowl is the room that we meet in every morning at 9:30 to talk about the deals that we have. And so what we focus on, again, our target markets are public universities over 10,000 students, high research activity, the Carnegie classification R1 and R2. We like stable or growing enrollment projections, diverse economic employment growth, and we think that's really important to the stability of the whole market so that market rate doesn't begin to impede upon your student product, your student demand. Obviously, high to moderate barriers of entry, strong supply and demand characteristics, high growth markets. All those are pretty typical, I would think, of people in our industry. You know, we target pedestrian or with reasonable distance to campus, the ability to amenitize appropriately. We, as I said before, we also have a value add strategy that we're looking, you know, beyond the infill product to the mile and beyond product on a value add basis. And the average cost of our assets are either acquisition or development are anywhere between $25 million to $75 million.
Gotcha. Anything that you're seeing as far as, or anything you guys are focusing on versus tier one to tier two and tier three?
We probably are not focused on tertiary markets. And that is obviously, you know, what is a tertiary market? Everybody's got their own idea of specifically what tertiary markets are. We know we've got some investors that we work with that only like major metropolitan markets. And so we, you know, have a focus geared towards that. We have other investors that like core product, but they don't mind being in a university town, so outside of that metropolitan market. And then we've got some investors that like the value add, and they're okay in any market that has a reasonable set of parameters that I just outlined. You know, we have historically not gone into some of the tertiary markets just because of the thin nature of the demand, as well as the private universities that have the ability to require students to live on campus beyond their freshman and sophomore years even. So we've stayed away from those private universities in most cases as well.
Great. Well, hey, my last question, which has kind of been a recurring theme during this series, there are $1.7 billion of CMBS loans that are set to mature in 2023, and 20% of those are currently on the watch list. In your opinion, what kind of impact is this going to have on the industry, and what opportunities do you feel like it will create, both from an acquisition and a disposition side, but mainly on the acquisition side?
Sure. And, you know, we have the same question at all of our conferences back in 2010, I guess, where we had a lot of product that was delivered in pre-recession. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of short-term loans and they were coming due. And, you know, what was going to happen to those? And I think that, you know, we saw certainly some issues where people had to sell in the down cycle of their asset, and the buyers got to take opportunity in that. We will probably see that again. You know, as long as the agencies are still in place going forward, and as long as the financing vehicles that we have in place today stay strong on the student housing asset class, I think that, you know, getting those refinanced, recapped, or selling out into the market and having buyers like us come in, we'll be able to find the money for those deals. You know, you're saying that there's a surplus maybe on the watch list. You know, those are a function of obviously oversupply or functionality. You know, those products maybe being somewhat obsolete. And so for us, the opportunity is to go in and take a look. Again, if they are in good markets and they are have a good history, and they have the ability to add that capital and show a business plan in return, then the lenders are going to listen to companies like ours that do that for a living and can reposition those deals to be good investments going forward. And you know, we love to recap deals that we have. And we have had more success on the second and third recaps of some of our deals than on the initial acquisition and refi or recap. So I would say that those deals, as long as they are good deals, they have the ability to be refreshed capital-wise, and they're in healthy markets, that those deals will find places on the on refinance. And so for us, you know, there'll be opportunities that we look at, and I don't think that there's going to be a significant swell of distressed assets that are going to be facing a disposition in the down cycle. But that's my personal opinion.
Great, great. Well, Susan, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure talking to you as always. And really quick, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you to either look at getting services from Price or talking with you about potential investment opportunities, what's the best place to get a hold of you?
Please reach out. Susan Folkemer is my full name, but you can reach me at susan@tpco.com. And my phone number, 919-410-9597. And thank
Perfect.
You, Wes.
Well, and this episode will actually be launching right at the beginning of NMHC, which starts on September 25th, and it should be launching that night. So if anyone's listening to this on a plane ride, headed to Tampa, if was talking to Susan earlier, and she's going to be there. So if that's a good time for you to meet with Susan, I'm sure she would like to slot 15 minutes to talk. So Susan, anything else?
No, again, this is an exciting industry and asset class. And if you're involved in it today, I know you know what I mean. If you're just getting involved in it, good luck, and I'm happy to help in any way I can.
Awesome. Thanks, Susan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Wow. Even after listening to that interview again, there's just, I'm so surprised about the wealth of information that she has and how great of a interview she was.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of the very first thoughts that went through my head was a conversation based off of everything that, you know, she said, but was a conversation you and I had about, and I've mentioned this before, about why, you know, we wanted to do this and how we wanted it to exist. And it was a huge, we wanted that information to be shared. We wanted the wealth of knowledge to be spread to everybody that's, you know, within our industry, because let's be honest, I think everybody can agree that we have a tendency to be kind of stingy about it. And, you know, we don't want to share information. We just don't, you know, we're very competitive. And I believe that, you know, that competitive nature is wonderful, but I think that we're still a young industry, and sharing this information is really the best thing that we can do, especially considering the fact that at the base of this, we are all in this to provide phenomenal housing for and education for students who are currently in school. And I really feel like she hit that home. I didn't feel like she held anything back. I don't feel like she had in her head, you know, oh, I don't want to share that, you know, for whomever might be listening. She didn't do that. She answered those questions, and you know, I really love the information that she gave.
Yeah, and she's so humble about it too. I mean, even when there's been mistakes made, she's, you know, she wants to make sure that the people learn from those mistakes. So
so smart.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed her. So let's talk about a couple of takeaways.
All right, so I feel like it should be obvious, the very first thing that I wrote down and was super excited about, and it was market research. Totally said it.
That's so funny, because she was so, even when I was doing the interview, I was like, oh gosh, I need to commend her on that. Not like I
that
need
would
to
make
commend
me
her.
Sad I wasn't a part of it, because I was like, I would have made noises right there.
Yeah, and no, exactly. I mean, that's what we talked about, you know, in the first episode that you did, was, you know, these projects and these deals start with research, and if you haven't got that down,
yeah, then, you know, that success is, you're not really sure if you're going to get it. And, you know, it's the other thing that I loved that she said within that same answer was also ensuring that the operator that you're going to work with actually has the experience to be able to properly manage this. And you actually touched on that in that last podcast that you and I did together. And it's, you know, we nailed it home then. She brought it up again. I love that somebody else said it besides us, which, you know, you really have to make sure that these people are properly equipped with the experience necessary to see this project through in its entirety with all of the details. And they need that experience. You need to know that they have the experience, and don't just take these operators' words for it. If somebody's contacting you through the grapevine, or you know them, or you got to check their references and, you know, check on that experience and make sure that it's there. I love that she said that, because there are a million good reasons that she gave just in that one answer as to why it's so important to have an experienced operator in a project like that. I love it.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, when I first got started in this business, the operators were either someone kind of, you know, homegrown doing it internally, like Donna Price and her organization, or it was, you know, there were a ton of multifamily operators out there that were getting involved, but really didn't understand, you know, didn't have the understanding of student housing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny now that the equity guys and the institutional money are now saying, hey, you've got to have an experienced operator in place to manage these sites. So it's really just kind of funny to see how things like that have changed, and how kind of organically Price Company's been a part of that of that evolution, as well as, you know, many other companies that are operating today. And I think that's that that's kept a lot of, in recent years, that's kept a lot of management companies from, you know, coming in and taking the space over. Any other takeaways?
Yeah, there were. So she mentioned the whole piece about late delivery, and I love that she spoke to it. I love that she made such key points about it, because I, you know, I've got to say that one of my biggest frustrations, because projects are being developed all over the country at any given time, we just know that it's inevitable. And, you know, in my experience, I've been on both ends of the spectrum. I've been with a developer who, in my opinion, and based off of all of the numbers that, you know, I'll give out here in a moment, that it was done phenomenally well. And then there was another one where, you know, they kept missing that delivery deadline. They actually did it 2 years in a row, and it made for a PR disaster. And for people to think, you know, going into this, that it's going to finish exactly on time and everything's going to be fine, or we'll deal with it when we get there, this isn't for you if that's the case, you know, because in the former situation that went phenomenally well, that was a situation where my CEO looked at me and he said, every time he looked at me, he saw $1 million. Because when we realized that that project was going to be delivered late, it was, we hit the, you know, the meeting room and it was boom, boom, boom. Here's everything we're going to need to do with these students in order to make up for the fact that their home was not ready in time for them to start for school. And we did all of it. And I tell you what, sure enough, they had a 60% retention year or retention rate that year, and they reached 100% before anybody else in that highly competitive market. And then that property sold not too long ago, and they got a great price for it. And obviously, a lot has to do with, you know, it was a great property, it was all of that. But we've seen great properties that don't finish on time, and they struggle for 2 years after that because of it. We've seen it.
Yeah, it all comes down to execution. Same thing that David Helfrich stated in his interview as well. It's all about execution and delivering that on time. That seems to have now been a theme over the past three or four podcasts. and that's, you know, again, this first series has everything to do with the reason I'm doing it is to, you know, help many of the clients that I've got that are new to the space to really understand, hey, what's the most important thing that you need to know going into student housing as a, you know, as a new venture? And over and over again, you've got to be ready on time. You can't have a delay. And that is going to.
But if you do have that plan, that's it. Just make sure you have a plan and that it's flawless, because you have to remember that whatever plan you put in place is representative of the type of service and product that you will be providing those students for the entirety of their lease term. That's the, you know, the point that people need to remember. You're representing your product.
Yeah. And then that plan has to be replicated every year during term.
So it was funny, though, because we got to, I think, right. So my the reason why I'm saying that is it's my last note on it. And we got to a certain point where I was listening and I was like, all right, Wes, you need to wrap it up at this point. But the reality is that very next question that you asked her, I actually absolutely loved it. And I was so grateful that it was included. And it was all of the information on acquisitions. It was such a great question. And it was, she gave, again, just what I consider to be a very beautifully stated and concise answer. I loved it. So, you know, I'm not going to give you too much grief over the fact that this podcast is as long as it is this time, maybe, except for right now.
I don't know really how to respond to that. It's all about providing great content to our folks. So anyway, well, hey, I'll miss you next week.
Oh, yeah, you will.
I've got a packed schedule while I'm in Tampa, but for any of the listeners that may be listening to this while they're at the conference, headed down to the conference, headed back, please search me out. Would love to talk to you and what you think about the podcast, as well as any questions you may have. You know, what's great about having both me, you, and April now on this podcast, just like I was speaking with someone last week and being able to say, hey, that's more of an on-campus question, but while I've got some good thoughts on it, I think it's best if we bring April in and, you know, was able to make that introduction. And, you know, I think it's going to be great information that client's going to get from her. So, you know, please, I don't want everybody to think that this is Wes's podcast. The reason I've got these these two other ladies here with me is the immeasurable resources that they are when it comes to marketing and leasing with Greta, and then on-campus perspectives from April. So anyway, let's wrap it up. One last thing. Again, I want to thank studenthousingsites.com for sponsoring this episode. Again, studenthousingsites.com is owned by Mike Spencer, and he is taken the process of listing properties, so you're not just dealing with LoopNet. He's really crowdsourcing the process for listing land opportunities in college markets, and to even go a little bit beyond that, he's doing a lot of the market research work beforehand. I'll just go ahead and give a preview with our sponsors. We're going to be doing a Behind the Biz little 15-minute podcast, and I recorded his podcast today. And, you know, one of the things that he's doing, and that he's also using Providential Student Housing for, is to actually make first contact with the university administration to find out, you know, where things are headed with enrollment and what the bed to student ratio is. So that there's a lot of that information that he's already vetted and a lot of contacts he's already made before you guys even get a chance to look at the opportunity. So
that's fantastic.
Great. Yeah, great, great value there. All right, guys, I appreciate it. Take care and have a nice week.
Bye.